a panel of experts. We have quite the history sitting here. Gardner's World is how old?
Since 1972.
Since 1972. Whitfield Nursery since?
My grandfather started back in 1946.
And then in today's business section of the Arizona Republic, they've got Berridge Nurseries on there celebrating their 75th. So it's actually really neat to see. There's not a lot of old history. You know, Arizona's just now 100 years old. There's not a lot of things that are that old in the state. So it's neat to see things and industries that have histories and generations that are keeping it going. So we appreciate y'all being here representing that. And
hey, and I'd like to say that the Myrovi family that I grew up has celebrated 100 years here in Arizona. We started farming here in 1912.
Out 1912,
right over by where Christown is now. There's Rovi Avenue and Kime Drive, named after my family.
Like I said, a lot of history here today at Rosie on the House.
Well, you got the, if you got the Wheats, we have to mention
too. So Wheats and Norman's Nursery.
They had nurseries here, at the turn of the century, and we're here for quite a while, and still some of them are architects here in the Valley. And the Berridges, we both knew Jim Berridge Jr. pretty well. I mean, think of him as Jr., a little older than we are,
yes.
But he was quite a guy. And, you think of him just for flowers now, but in their day, they had tree farms and did different things as well. And so it's been a great place to be associated with agriculture. And, that's the one thing that we're trying to do is really kind of keep this agricultural presence going for our families, for generations to come. It's really a lot of fun farming here in Arizona, and it's been a great life, and hopefully we can keep a lot of young people in it.
And we do. And Romy goes out hunting with some of my nephews and nieces.
The Romy Dairy on 67th Avenue with Eric.
75th
Avenue,
right
in Northern.
And those young ones are coming up and still farming.
And I will say, your nephew's crazy. I cannot believe the stuff he does with his plane, but we won't mention any of it on air. We don't want to give anyone else ideas. 1-888-767-4348. Eva has called in with a question on her roses. Good morning, ma'am. Welcome to the program. How may our experts here this morning help you?
Yes, good morning. I have a problem with my roses where I have that white dusting powder all over, and I just can't get rid of it. Anything I can use?
Oh, Eva, I think that you've got some powdery mildew on those, and that is something that you can take care of with a rose defense or with neem oil, which is you can spray those on. You can get them in a ready-to-use, or you can mix them up. But for you, probably a ready-to-use is going to be the easiest. And in a few weeks, we're probably going to get a little bit hotter, and by the time we hit about 105 degrees, which I hope is not too soon, the powdery mildew is going to pretty much go away as well.
Now, if she just leaves it and waits for the heat, is that going to hurt her roses at all, or should she go ahead and get some product on there?
You're going to miss one nice bloom. But, other than missing that one nice bloom right now, not going to hurt them at all. Just go on vacation for 3 weeks, come back, and you'll have new flowers and green leaves.
Outstanding. We've been talking a little bit about the transition time with the heat coming from winter, the perennial rye lawns, to the summer Bermudas. What do homeowners that do multi-lawns and do it themselves, or maybe want to, new to the Valley, and make that transition, what do they need to know?
It's a great time to kill the winter grass. It's beautiful right now. It's going to be really hard. Politically, sometimes incorrect. A spouse might just really enjoy the way it looks, but
ours looks beautiful.
If you mow it short and shut the water off, leave it off for about 10 days, you'll kill that ryegrass. And it'll be a huge benefit to your perennial grass, whether it's a tiffway or mid-iron, whatever kind of sod you may have. And it's going to come back much better and much nicer. The problem is the new perennial ryegrass that we use here is just lush and beautiful, but it can last all the way through June if we have mild weather. And the sooner you kill it, the happier, the better your summer lawn will be.
And if we let it go through into June, yeah, I mean, we're crippling and bringing our summer, like August, September, or does it come in at all?
Well, it'll come in, but the problem is you finally get a nice lawn by August, and then, you want to kill it again in September, aren't you?
Yeah, September, October, yes.
Realistically, I do love having a winter lawn at our house. We have a winter lawn in the front and just a natural Bermuda grass lawn in the back. But what we do is we don't overseed till the 1st of November, and we try to get the water shut off right now and mowed short and get rid of that ryegrass.
Now, on lawn, y'all think you could take a lawn question at 8,000 feet?
Sure.
All right, Neil in Flagstaff, listening on Calf Country. Welcome to the program. We appreciate the call this morning at 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. Welcome to the program, Neil.
Ah, thank you. So I, every couple of years, get a snow mold abundance. And I used to work on a golf course, and we used to get it out there. And what can we use to eliminate the damage that snow mold causes?
Well, you're going to have the damage is done in the wintertime. Then you just want to kind of get the lawn going back good in the summer. But what you might try to do is treat with a little bit of copper. And the Bordeaux is, I think, gone off the market now. But any kind of a copper product sprayed on in the wintertime should reduce the mold and should help the lawn come out nicer in the spring.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right.
Neil,
and
appreciate
it. What about locust trees? I got a couple of those, and the roots just go everywhere, and they come up in the weirdest places.
Well, they will, but, you know, really with locusts, they're a very deep-rooted tree naturally. So what you want to do is make sure they're deep-watered. And if you're sprinkling or trying to grow in ground covers and other small things around the plant, you're going to have a problem with surface roots. So try not to water so frequently.
And the other thing is some of the Dispersol or First-Step Soil Acidifier helps to make that water go down deeper. And that's where we always want the water, down deep. So long, slow watering.
Long, slow watering. How does somebody accomplish long, slow watering? I've seen those stakes that you stick in the ground that are perforated. I've seen people leave a hose on for 12 hours. What's the best way to deep water?
Well, it really depends a lot here on the type of soil you have. Here in the valley, we go from heavy clay to rocky soil. Rocky soil, it's going to go right down. There's no big point in putting water on slowly. But my idea with irrigation, and Sharon's probably is too, is old farmer kind of types, is that really you want to get your water on as fast as you can so you lose as least bit possible to evaporation. But, you know, what's practical in different kind of landscapes can be very different. So I personally like bubblers, which are old style, kind of retro 1970s. But then you have to have wells around your plants and areas to capture the water, which kind of mimic our flood irrigation, which put on properly can be very efficient. Nowadays, we see a lot more drip systems.
Now, on the wells, I don't think I see very small wells a lot of time for trees that you kind of wonder, how is that tree even getting water? I mean, the size of the well is pretty significant.
Well, what happens is that the soil actually subs, is what we call it. So the water is going to go and contact itself right through the soil. So if you put your hose down, if you spill a glass of water in the ground, you know, you're going to notice that the water doesn't just wet the area that immediately where it fell, but it's going to sub out away from the area. So if you're putting water on slowly and deeply, then even if you have a well around a tree that's only 6 foot in diameter, if you really flood it, you're going to cover maybe a 10 or 12 foot swath of land. So you don't really have to have the well as full, as big as the drip line. And it's kind of a thing with our drip irrigation systems. You know, there's so many different kinds of heads and such minor amounts of water. Some of these are only 1 gallon and 2 gallon per hour. You know, you take a big shade tree, say like a big, an ash tree or a pistachio tree, it's going to want to get about 100 to 200 gallons of water, depending on the soil type, at least once or twice a week in the summertime. If you want your big mosquito palverina to grow fast, it's going to use every bit as much water as that ash or elm tree would. So you really have to get good deep irrigations, but to be healthy, you have to dry the soil out. You know, the most common error that I see in irrigation, and Sharon would probably concur, is that people put a drip system in, they run it every day for an hour. You know, there's really no plant unless some little annual has just been newly installed that needs to be watered every day. And an hour is not going to be enough with a small drip system of plants of any size.
You were talking about that emotional connection and not cutting down a tree. It's very hard to not turn that water on when you see it kind of maybe the leaf curling and it just looks a little dehydrated and dry. And even though I watered it yesterday, man, I got to put water on it today.
We call that hoseitis. You've got the hoseitis. It's better to, more people kill more plants by watering too much than by not watering enough. But remember, as that tree grows, your drip system needs to move out because the roots have moved out. Your drip system should go out as far as the canopy of the tree.
And then the thing is, too, you really got to up that time. Because that little 15-gallon tree that you planted that might be fine with 5 gallons of water twice a week is now a 30-foot canopy tree that's going to need 100 or 200 gallons, you know, once a week.
We have Katie who's called in at 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. Katie, welcome to the program. How may we help you this morning?
Hi, guys. I just had a question if you guys think it's a legitimate goal to try to plant some hydrangea in the back porch of my house.
What part? You're in Phoenix?
Yes. I have north and south exposure, or no, east-west exposure.
Hydrangeas are sold in the box stores, and they're pretty when you buy them, but this is not the climate to grow hydrangeas. Go to San Francisco, okay. Go to other places, and you can have them. You can do all your different mixes on them and have them in white and pink and purple and blue, but Phoenix is not a great place for hydrangeas.
I'm not a landscaper or a florist or anything. I don't know what a hydrangea is. If she wanted something similar, what would be the closest thing this climate could offer her?
You know, there's a lot of fun different opportunities, but the basic stuff you see are things like hibiscus, which have a lot of big flowers and a lot of color. But you know, if you've got an area that's relatively frost-free that'll take the heat quite well, you might try an Ixora, which has got a really nice tropical flower to it. You do have to protect it from the cold. In fact, it really won't take weather much below 40 degrees, so you have to cover and protect it. But if you want those clusters of flowers like that, you know, they can be a lot of fun with Ixora.
1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you on this post-Arbor Day broadcast of the Rosie on the House program. We're going to come back and run through the top list of big shade trees recommended by Harper's. We'll get the input from Whitfield's and Gardener's World as well. 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you.